With us now is therapist and psychologist Dr. Deborah Phillips. She's the author of How to Fall Out of Love. And it's certainly easier to go into a relationship than get out, right, Bonnie?
That's true. I mean, for most people. Hi, Dr. Phillips.
Hello there. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. That's right, morning for you. So Valentine's Day, of course, does celebrate the joys of love, but for many, it can be a particularly painful day. You say that the death of a relationship can be even worse than the death of a loved one. Why is that?
Well, when someone dies, they don't move on to somebody else. So jealousy, which is a powerful and painful emotion, is not in play. And that's the difference.
Well, you're a behavioral therapist, and you don't really ascribe to the traditional therapy. Could you give us a thumbnail of behavior therapy? How does it differ from other therapies?
Well, a thumbnail would take a year, but I'll try to give it to you quickly. It's short-term, it's direct. We don't spend years on the whys, the background of childhood, toilet training, your relationship to your mother or father. I'm interested in that, but not for years. Traditional therapy really does a 20-year history, so to speak, and I do a four-hour history, and then directly attack and cure the anxiety or the difficulty that the person is bringing. And we do that through certain techniques that involve conditioning and training in communication skills, relationship issues. And in the How to Fall Out of Love program, it's particularly it's a particular example of how to short-circuit the pain rather than talking about it for years, which can make it worse. Because if you talk about something like the person you're trying to fall out of love with, you can reinforce. The pain gets reinforced. The attachment gets reinforced instead of cut. And there are some major differences right there.
Mm-hmm.
Deborah Phillips, it seems that in most relationships there's a dominant figure who makes the decision to end the relationships. I've been on both sides. I've been the dumpy and the dumper. But what are the dynamics behind that?
Well, they're very painful. Even the person who is the dumper tells me that he or she feels guilt and pain about doing it. But it's the person who's been, quote, dumped, who is in deep mourning and worse. As I said, it's worse than death, because it's a feeling of rejection. One of the most painful, I said jealousy was profoundly painful, and rejection is high up there as well. Being rejected by someone whom you feel loved you, there couldn't be anything worse. If that person who loved me has rejected me, I must be worthless, because after all, I was kept in high regard by that person, and now they've told me goodbye. So the self-esteem of someone who's been rejected has been destroyed.
So what does behavior therapy teach one about that rejection and low self-esteem or feelings of worthlessness?
Well, I have a whole program to build the self-image of the person who's been rejected, because that's a key. It's one of the core parts of the program, because the self-image has been destroyed, and so we have to start from the beginning to build it in many, many ways. One thing I do is teach assertiveness, which helps a self-image. Complimenting oneself, finding the good things in oneself, it takes a while. It's not that easy when the self-image has been so destroyed. But I repair it with many techniques of building self-esteem. It's key. The higher one's self-esteem, the less one feels the rejection.
How about when opposites in a relationship really define someone? The man who has the trophy wife, the woman who married the CEO, and then they're let go.
That's so common, and it's very unfortunate. I don't know that we should get married for life. There's been talk about 5-year contracts for marriage, maybe 10-year. It's probably a lot more realistic. People often marry without knowing what they're doing. If they marry young, anyone who marries before they're 21 or marries because they're pregnant has the highest risk of a dissolved relationship.
Are those statistics, I mean, is that from research?
Yes, yes. Those are the worst statistics. But, you know, how much worse can we get with a 50% divorce rate in this country?
Right.
And then beyond that, how many people who aren't divorced are, quote, stuck in unhappy situations? It's a bleak picture, isn't it?
Well, something else occurred to me, too. It occurred to me that people are often in a pattern of choosing the wrong person. Over and over again, they choose, like, a different person, but it's the same, you know, has a different face, but the same person. So how does behavior therapy address that issue?
Well, we look at that with the person, you know, who did you pick? Was it for the twinkle in his eye? Was it because she reminded you of your mother? You know, there are many dynamics in that choice. Often it is, you know, love at first sight because someone has a way of walking into a room that attracts. It's hard to define chemistry, the chemistry of attraction. It's the stuff that mystery is made of.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not always easy to identify the pattern because of this power of attraction, which is powerful. And unfortunately, you know, this love at first sight doesn't look into all the qualities that are needed for a good relationship. They're often just glossed over because of this strong, compelling attraction.
Because you're a therapist and specialize in this kind of behavior, you must really see some very obsessive cases. If someone needs to go to a therapist because of a breakup.
Yes, many people who break up, time heals. But sometimes time makes it worse for the people that come to see me. I have seen people after suicide attempts. This is very serious, and this thing we call puppy love needs to be taken much more seriously because there's an epidemic of teenage suicide. And much of it is based on rejection, not only rejection in love, but rejection by, you know, a circle of people. Like the Columbine shooters, they were rejected, marginalized kids who had nothing to lose. So they could kill others and then turn the guns on themselves. But there's a lot of rejection in adolescent society, and that causes great problems.
Is there also a humorous side, though? This is pretty heady stuff. But
well, you know, the songs are humorous, but the feelings aren't really humorous, not when there's rejection involved.
Do you think that the internet is making things worse in terms of the social networking sites? And because you started a program on bullying, evidently.
Yes. Much worse. Now the bullying goes viral, and it's awful. People are now often rejected before they meet the person,
mm-hmm.
Because it's online. And there's hurt, deep hurt. I mean, there are many other problems with the internet, but we're focusing on this one, and it can be terrible. Not only are they rejected online, but after a breakup, I know of one person who's seen his ex online enjoying himself, you know, traveling from one country to the other. It's being posted on Facebook.
Right, or with another person.
Exactly. And, of course, you know, when I saw this person, I directed her to stop looking on Facebook. But, you know, it's ubiquitous. I mean, it's just omnipresent. Facebook is everywhere, and these, quote, friends are not the kinds of friends that we have talked about in the past as friends.
Right. We're speaking with Dr. Deborah Phillips. She's a behavior therapist and a sex therapist, a teacher, author, and lecturer. Her latest book is How to Fall Out of Love, and it's topical currents. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair. I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair. I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair and send him on his way. Get the picture? I'm going to wave that man right out of my arms. I'm going to wave that man right out of my arms. I'm going to wave that man right out of my arms and send him on his way. Don't try to patch it up.
Tear it up, tear it up.
Wash him up, dry him up.
Push him up, fly him up.
Cancel him and let him go.
Yay, sister. I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair. I'm going to wash that
man. Do you know who's singing that song, Bonnie?
I do.
Who?
Mitzi Gaynor from South Pacific.
That's right. Well, we're speaking with Dr. Deborah Phillips. She's a behavioral therapist, and she's written the book How to Fall Out of Love. And certainly there's nothing painless about that, but I guess you could also have to look at it with a grain of salt and kind of shrug your shoulders and say, that's it. Is that correct, Doctor?
Would that people could. The feelings run too deep. That song could be a wonderful prophecy if it could be done. And for some people, they can do it. But for the majority of people, it's rather impossible because there are deep feelings. And the feelings of rejection run so deep and are so difficult that people have a very hard time doing this.
But aren't some breakups kind of a breath of fresh air? You've been in a relationship where there's been fighting and verbal abuse and the silent treatment, and finally it's like a breath of fresh air that, I'm finally out of this.
Absolutely. And when it's a mutual decision, it's a wonderful one because there's been so much rancor and, as you say, fighting, screaming, disagreements that...
Throwing things.
Right. And abuse. Emotional abuse and verbal abuse. And I have helped those people dissolve a relationship. And that's a much easier task than when what they're remembering are the romantic picnics and the moonlight walks, which is what people tend to do after a breakup. They remember the best. They put the person up on a pedestal who hardly deserves to be up on a step. But, you know, that's just done.
One of the techniques you use is this yelling stop. I forget what it's called.
Thought stopping.
So this is when somebody's thinking obsessively about a former lover. And then when it keeps coming up, you say, you yell stop as loud as you can when you think about the former lover.
Right.
But the one, I question that because in my experience, we usually get what we resist, as in, don't think about pink elephants. So how does that work exactly?
Well, it has to be done split-second timing. Almost before the thought comes in, it's wiped out, and it's replaced. You can't go to a vacuum. That's why the thinking about, don't think about pink elephants doesn't work, because the thought needs to be replaced with a pleasurable one that has nothing to do with the former love. And people practice this on purpose first, so that when they need it, when things come in by themselves, they're ready for it, and they can just wipe it out instantaneously. And that's the key word. It must be wiped out almost before it comes in.
You touched on the negative side of the internet, but isn't there a positive side as well, being that so many people date online now, and it can get you back into circulation quicker?
Absolutely. That is positive. Also, the internet is wonderful for people who are lonely and can't get out very much. But many people have met successfully online, have, in fact, gotten married. So, yes, I guess most negatives have a positive on the other side. Mm-hmm. You're right.
It's also easy to be deluded on the internet if someone represented themselves as something that they aren't.
Yes. I heard a story about...
And they send a picture that looks like Brad Pitt.
Well, but soon enough, the person finds out that...
Right. It could go on for years.
I've heard many humorous stories about that. When they finally do meet in person, you know, what the reality is versus the internet image. It can be very deceptive.
How long do you usually tell someone to wait before they get into a new relationship? I realize it depends on the person and the relationship, but how does one know if they're just rebounding?
They need to get over the relationship they just came from before they jump into something new. You know, there's a saying, there's no getting over an old love. There's nothing like a new love for getting over an old love, right?
Right.
But there's where, as you so wisely said earlier, you know, people may repeat the pattern and jump into a relationship with someone just like the person who was hurting them before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important to be over the old love and to have a better self-image. Because if you go into a relationship with a negative self-image, you're not picking someone who's, quote, good enough for you, because you don't feel good enough about yourself.
Have you had any clients that found out the relationship was over by a Dear John or Dear Jane letter?
Oh, cruelly. I had a patient at Princeton University who was just left, no letter, nothing, left for Athens, Georgia, or Athens, Greece. I mean, she never found out. He just left. They were engaged. So, yes, you can't pick a situation that's terrible that I haven't seen. These situations. And she had attempted suicide.
Mm. What about this practice you do of silent ridicule? What is that?
Oh, I love that. Because that's when I often hear the first chuckle, which is like music to my ears, because this person who's been rejected is typically really depressed. And the silent ridicule is used to crumble the pedestal they've put that person on. And I have them design, and I help them, the silliest, most ridiculous image they can possibly have of this person, like the person bald, toothless, picking their nose, holding a red balloon at an important meeting. And once they chuckle at that, the curative process has really begun.
And even in the wee hours of the night. I mean, I realize in your office they can chuckle and they get that image, but I just can't imagine that the other, you know, the beautiful moonlight boat ride, you know, romantic, that that doesn't come into their mind.
Well, they need to practice this image at least 10 times a day. All of this is conditioning. It must be practiced. I never assume they're going to get it just because we do it in the office a few times.
Right.
And so I will make a tape if that's necessary and they listen to it. But practice, the person needs to want to fall out of love when they come to see me and we embark on this program, because it takes work and practice to do it.
I just was interested. Now, we just have about 45 seconds left, but you're a sex therapist and a behavior therapist. What is the intersection between those two?
Well, when they are re-entering, I mean, I do sex therapy separately, but in this program, when they have fallen out of love and they go to, and they're re-entering the world of social intercourse, shall we say, they may need help with the sexuality of all of that.
I see.
And that's where my skills in human sexuality come into play.
Well, Dr. Deborah Phillips, she has 35 years of experience as a behavior therapist and sex therapist. And her latest book that she wrote with Robert Judd is entitled How to Fall Out of Love. Dr. Deborah Phillips, thanks so much for joining us today, and happy Valentine's Day.
It's been a pleasure, and happy Valentine's Day to all of your listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And we're back with today's topical currents, Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. In 1986, actress Angelica Houston won an Oscar for her portrayal of a mafia princess in the film Prissy's Honor. It was one of the last films directed by her father, John Houston. Angelica Houston has written a memoir which chronicles her complex relationship with her famous and larger-than-life father. The book is A Story Lately Told and chronicles her efforts to emerge from her father's shadow. Angelica Houston spoke with Topical Currents literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez, who asked why she calls her father a lonesome pine.
I think it was because there were no other trees around quite like him in the forest. He was a very individual thinker. He, just when you thought you had my father clocked, he'd come up with a new color. Just when you thought my father was liberal, he would suddenly be Victorian. He was a man of many facets and colors. And hard to peg.
Well, what fascinates me about your father was that he had an exceptional life before he was famous. What kind of things did he do before he became a director?
Well, when he was very young, he was diagnosed with Bright's disease, which was an enlargement of the heart. His father, meanwhile, was a famous vaudevillian called Walter Houston. His mother was a crime reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and which was extremely rare for a woman in those days. My father was confined to his bed for a couple of years with this disease and thought that he wouldn't live past that, and then kind of found his way through by having a sort of a secret assignment with a sluice that ran behind his gate, his house. Sorry, I'm going to have to start again on this, but there was a river that was let out from a dam, and he decided to ride the wave and was hit so hard by the wave that it tossed him up onto the side of the bank. And from that day on, that night on, he rode the wave. So I think he discovered that he could defy early on the sort of confinements of various people who told him what he could or couldn't do.
Yes, he was also a boxer. He was a painter. He was.
He rode in the Mexican cavalry.
He rode in the Mexican cavalry, surrounded by thugs. He was down and out in Paris, a homeless beggar.
He was a busker, a busker in London. Yeah.
And all this before he ever directed his first film.
Yeah, he was a screenwriter, and he did many things. He also wrote a play called Frankie and Johnny. So he was writing early on.
Well, speaking of writers, what I notice about your father's movies is that many of them are adaptations of literary works. The Maltese Falcon, The Asphalt Jungle, Moby Dick, Reflections in a Golden Eye, Fat City, they're all adapted from novels. What was his relationship with the writers who were he collaborated with on those screenplays?
Well, Dad loved a good story, and he liked to go straight to the source. I remember the first writer that I met in Courtown House in Ireland when I was growing up was the writer Dalton Trumbo, who was a blacklisted writer. And I remember long sessions of them writing together. I'm not quite sure on what, because that was after Moby Dick. Then, of course, many other writers came to St. Clarens. Sartre, when he was directing Freud, Arthur Miller before The Misfits, Carson McCullers on a trip just to see the house and to visit his home. So he was very attracted to writers. He loved the written word. He was always reading something.
We're speaking with Angelica Houston about her memoir, A Story Lately Told. Recently, there was a book, Conversations with Orson Welles, that was written by Henry Jaglom, the director. And it's a series of conversations that Jaglom had with Welles before he died. Welles was a very good friend of your father's. They collaborated sometimes together. And there's a quote in the book about your father where Welles says, there's a difference between me and John Huston that I am, again, this comes from Welles, I'm an artist, whereas John will take any movie that comes down the pike. Was that fair or unfair?
Well, I don't think Orson was a gambler on quite the level that my father was. And so maybe, or as I recollect, a father. And my father had a great many bills to pay. And so maybe that prevented him from being quite in as elite a position as Orson at the time. Although Orson, I believe, was not disinclined to do things for monetary reasons.
Let's not forget those wine commercials.
That's right. Let's not forget those. Well, it's very, very easy for the kettle to call the pot black. They collaborated on a movie towards the end of Orson's life called The Other Side of the Wind, a movie that is still to be seen, can you imagine? I know that Henry's been trying, along with Peter Bogdanovich, to help that see the light of day.
Let's talk about your relationship with your father. What was it like? What kind of father was he?
He was taller than any of the other fathers. He spoke with an American accent. He had a beautiful melodic voice that came deep from his chest. He took big strides. He had a pride to him. He was the king of the jungle. He was carefully unstudied. He was witty. He was funny. He was courtly. He had beautiful manners. He was either compassionate or he could go after someone. He was acute when he wanted to be. He was extremely critical. He was very searching.
Searching in what way?
he would fix those brown monkey eyes on you, and he could really observe. He was a fantastic observer and of human nature. And he liked all kinds of people. He wasn't a snob. I think he saw charm in character, and that's what interested him. And he was a survivor. He was an adventurer. He liked big open spaces where he could explore and imagine. He was never petty. I think he had a deep compassion.
We're speaking with Angelica Houston about her memoir, A Story Lately Told. There's one thing that he told you that caught my eye about dilettantism, because your father, once he committed to something, he was all in. What did he say about dilettantes?
He said that dilettantism, and it, coming from him, it sounded like a crime. It sounded like worse than lying or stealing or anything else. He had contempt for people who dabbled. He thought that it was superficial to simply scrape the surface of life, and that one should dig in and commit oneself. He had great contempt for dabblers and people who didn't take life seriously, I think.
You worked with him on your first film. He directed you in your first film. How old were you?
I was 16.
You were 16. What was the experience like?
Not very good. First of all, he was accused of nepotism. We were not getting along terribly well at the time. He was critical. He didn't like the way that I was growing up, my adolescent traits, my preference for a lot of makeup and short skirts and such. And I think that was all hard for him. He was coming to terms with all of that, but I was not it was not a moment where I really appreciated the criticism, and he could be harsh in his judgment. So I spent most of that film trying to avoid him, which is an odd position for an actor and a director.
The movie didn't do very well, did it?
No, it didn't do well. It has some charm, but I didn't know what I was doing, and I wasn't particularly happy playing the part. So it was a difficult period.
But 20 years later, you worked with him again on Prissy's Honor, and that was a completely different experience, wasn't it? Because you won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress.
Well, it was a great part, as opposed to a kind of wishy-washy part, which was the movie that I'd made at 16. I remember Jack Clayton at one point, when my brother and I were quite small children, offering for us to play the part of the innocents. And I think I would have been a much better innocent than young lady Claudia de Saint-Jean in A Walk with Love and Death.
All right. Well, we need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with Angelica Houston. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is Academy Award-winning actress Angelica Houston, whose memoir, A Story Lately Told, looks at the first 22 years of her life. Why do you end the book at that point in your life, around 1972, 1973?
Well, initially, this was supposed to be a full-life autobiography, but I think it just grew in size to the point where my publisher felt that it should be two books instead of one, and I know that she wanted to get a book out this year. So that's how that came to be.
Now, when, at that point, around 21, 22, you've begun a career as a model. What made you want to be a model?
I was very attracted to fashion, to appearance, to costume, to transformation, and to beautiful women. I love the way my mother looked, for instance, when she was in the ballet. I remember talking to my mother. I mean, she must have been in her, at most, her early 30s at the time, as though she were an old woman past her prime. You know, "Oh, you were so beautiful when you were young," I said to her. That's what I liked. I liked young, beautiful women, gorgeous clothes, tiaras, makeup, well, hairdos.
You were also growing up in the, I think what may have influenced it to a slight degree was the 1960s in London, which was the time of Mary Quant and all the modish fashion at that time. What was it like being through that period?
It was fantastic. You know, it was a lot of originality and a lot of showing off. And that's what we did on Saturdays. We'd walk up and down the King's Road showing off. And there were various shops, great shops, boutiques, suddenly appeared all the way along the King's Road and also in Notting Hill Gate around the Portobello Road. So you were always dipping into these old antique dress shops like Antiquarius or Ozzie Clark's or, as you say, Mary Quant or Biba's, and all the girls, we were the Dolly girls. That was the look of the time, short skirts and black eyeliner and long ironed hair. And then we had these fantastic kind of role models like Marianne Faithfull and Patti Boyd and Jane Asher and Anita Pallenberg and any number of gorgeous women of the time, all who were kind of, I mean, I remember the sort of apex of gorgeousness.
And they all looked the same.
Well,
most of them were all
very influenced by Brigitte Bardot, who was the top look of the time. Brigitte Bardot and Twiggy, kind of combination thereof.
Well, you started your modeling career. You were photographed by the great Richard Avedon, and you appeared in Vogue. And I love this one story in your book about Diana Vreeland. Now, Diana Vreeland was the legendary editor of Vogue, a very original character. What was she like?
Diana Vreeland was she earned the nickname the Empress. For marked reasons. I mean, she had a really fantastic profile, a sort of carved profile with kabuki hair, black, jet black. She had small eyes, a red mouth, rouged cheeks. She wore many bracelets, and she was extremely flamboyant. She spoke in very round tones. She adored things. She didn't love things or like things. She was scary for a young girl. I was scared the first time I went up to her offices at Vogue. But she liked me, but she was a huge presence. And
she slapped you once, right? But in a nice way.
Yes, she was trying to bring me round because I actually fainted in her office. There was such a flurry of activity up in the Vogue offices, and the tension was at such a high level, I just passed out.
Well, we're speaking with Angelica Houston about her memoir, A Story Lately Told. Even though you were a model, you were still interested in acting, and you got to play Ophelia in a production of Hamlet. This was directed by Tony Richardson. And Hamlet was Nicole Williamson, a very interesting actor who never really got, I think, the credit that he deserved. But you were the understudy, weren't you?
Yes, I was understudying Marianne Faithfull. I read for the part, but I didn't get it. She got to be Ophelia. But she was kind of a great person to understudy because she missed quite a few performances through no fault of her own. She was not very well at the time. But it was good because I got to go on and I loved it. I got my legs under me in the five or six performances I got to go on. Of course, after London, Francesca Annis took over the part, and I didn't get to go on after that. It was disappointing.
Well, this is kind of like the dark point of the memoir, because around that time, or shortly after, you met another Richardson, Bob Richardson, a photographer, and you were involved with him for a number of years. And he was much older than you were. You were, I think, 18 at the time. He was
42.
And that was a very turbulent time. What happened there?
Well, he initially was assigned by Harper's Bazaar to photograph me for the magazine, and we went out to Jones Beach outside New York, and he was very mesmerizing. We worked that afternoon. I'd worked for Richard Avedon, but I hadn't worked for a photographer like this. It was a different experience. It was out of the studio. It was very personal. Bob was very, he seemed to me very invested. And after that, we started seeing each other, and it became a love affair.
But he was, and I have to be very direct about this, he was insane. He was schizophrenic. He was extremely, there were moments when he could be violent, at least not perhaps not to you, but certainly to your furniture and to your apartment. And you were with him for 4 years, weren't you? I mean, I'm going to have to ask the question, why did you stay with him?
Well, like many people who have very bad sides, he also had a very good side. It's never as simple as someone just being insane. He also was, I think, the parent that I was looking for at the time, even though he wasn't a good parent to me. It was still I must have been looking for that. We worked really well together. And I know it sounds really corny, but I was his muse. And he taught me how to work. He taught me how to model. And he taught me how to make the most of what I had. And some of the sessions that I did with Bob, especially the work that we did in Paris with the great makeup artist and designer Serge Lutens, those are some of the happiest memories I have in my entire working life. And, you know, yes, when he was horrid, he was horrid. But when he was good, he was very, very good and very understanding and very perceptive. And I felt that he knew me like nobody else, like no one had made the effort to know me since my mother.
Well, in 1987, I think, you did The Dead, which was the last film your father shot. And it is set in Ireland, and it's based on a great short story by James Joyce with an incredibly beautiful ending, one of the best endings, I think, in modern literature. But your father was dying at that time, wasn't he?
We're all dying, but he was dying at a rapid rate, yes.
And he had to do it on oxygen.
Yes, he did.
Because he had emphysema. Right?
He had emphysema, which meant that his carbon dioxide levels would go up very high and his oxygen way down. And he would start to kind of go off, and then we'd have to rush him to hospital and keep him awake sometimes for up to 4 or 5 days at a time, not allow him to sleep in case, you know, he went under and didn't come back.
And yet I'm still impressed with the movie. The fact that he was in that condition and yet he was still able to finish the film, I think, is a testament.
I think Pauline Kael said it was easier for him than breathing. It looked easier and breathing this movie. He was seamless. He was a fantastic director. It was, in a way, really great to observe him making The Dead because he was in a wheelchair and he couldn't move around too fast. So I got to watch him very closely. And he was at the top of his powers. He was incredibly on point on that film, I think, even though it was his last film.
Well, thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Angelica Houston.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. And that is Topical Currents for today. Thank you so much for listening. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction by Michael Stock. And Paul Leary is online producer. I think Michael also got the music for today's program. Thank you, Michael. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and previous programs at our website, WLRN.org, and more information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade County School Board meeting, and Thursday we examine the $1 billion Rising Miami program and hear from Linda Gassenheimer and Food and Dining. Thanks for joining us, Bonnie Berman, for Joseph Cooper. Stay with us for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.